This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. In August 1990, Anthony Swofford was deployed to Saudi Arabia as a lance corporal in a U.S. Marine Corps sniper platoon. He just turned 20. In his new memoir, Jarhead, about his experience during the Gulf War, Swofford describes the tedium and the absurdity and the loneliness of waiting in the desert for the ground war to begin. He writes of the relentless sand and heat, of bloodlust and the devastation of war. In a review, Mark Bowden called Jarhead a classic that will go down with the best books ever written about military life. He writes, as Swofford moves through a nightmare landscape of exploding ordnance, raining petroleum, the threat of invisible killing gases, and death, his terror and his joy are one. Swofford's fiction and nonfiction has appeared in the New York Times, Harper's, and the Iowa Review. Jarhead is his first book. We begin with a reading. In this passage, Swofford comes upon a group of dead Iraqi soldiers, still arranged in a circle around a campfire, where they had been surprised by American bombs.
6 tin coffee cups sit among the remains of the fire. The men's boots are cooked to their feet. The man to my right has no head. To my left, the man's head is between his legs, and his arms hang at his sides like the burnt flags of defeated countries. The insects of the dead are swarming. Though I can make out no insignia, I imagine that the man across from me commanded the unit, and that when the bombs landed, he was in the middle of issuing a patrol order. Tomorrow we will kick some American ass. It would be silly to speak, but I'd like to. I want to ask the dead men their names and identification numbers and tell them this will soon end. They must have questions for me, but the distance between the living and the dead is too immense to breach. I could bend at the waist, close my eyes, and try to join these men in their tight, dead circle. But I am not yet one of them. I must not close my eyes.
What made you go down there and sit with those corpses?
Fascination, wanting to become closer, more intimate with the devastation. Perhaps a hope that moving into that tight, dead circle that I would kind of find some distance between me and my own possible death that was forthcoming, maybe to the north, which is where we were heading to fight.
Were you told anything about how to prepare for combat or possible death? For instance, I don't know, to clean up your stuff in case you're killed and there might be something among your effects that would be embarrassing to your family.
It was probably a few days before ground combat began, and a few days prior to that, my platoon started running missions across the border. There was a big berm that had been built between Kuwait and Saudi Arabia, and we were right up at the berm for a few days and running missions across in the evening. But our staff sergeant directed us to get rid of, any Marine letters that weren't from your girlfriend or your wife, or pornography. It was anything that your wife or your girlfriend or your mother would rather not see. There was word that a few guys who died in a friendly fire incident, an A-10 had dropped a rather devastating bomb on a troop carrier. And there was word that among the effects of one of these guys who was married, there were, half a dozen photos and letters from various people that, may have been nothing serious and simply a way of finding solace over there for him. But, the word was get that stuff out of your ruck, out of your sea bag, bury it, burn it, get rid of it.
When you did first engage the enemy in combat, what happened?
Well, the first time we were in sort of a high spot in the desert, and our communication shop was setting up in an area where they would get the best reception, but where it also made us visible to an enemy observation post that was across the border and in a bit of a range. And so that first event was artillery rounds that were incoming on our position. We were just beginning to dig in around the battalion command post when the rounds came in. And, I didn't believe that they were artillery rounds exploding in front of me.
When the rounds hit the sand, what did it look like?
Well, for me, it looked like a flower blooming or exploding, and there's, you know, the sand is burnt a bit black, and there's a little explosion, so it's the burnt munitions along with the beige of the sand combining and then kind of raining down after the explosion.
Now, after the all-clear was called, what did you and the rest of your unit do? Did you set up to attack the enemy position?
Well, we were, as the forward observers for the battalion, that was our mission, and my partner Johnny was the first to gain visual on the enemy observation post, and with his guidance, along with another Marine, I gathered the map location of the enemy position and prepared a call for fire to put into the fire center. I was going to be asking for bombs from a plane, probably a Harrier. But just as I was about to make that call, a captain arrived who thought it best if he called the mission in. And so the handset of the radio was taken from my hands and handed off to this captain, who indeed made the call. And the bombs were impacting shortly thereafter on this enemy position across the way.
During your time in the Gulf War, did you train your sniper's rifle at a living being, and did you fire?
I did train my rifle on a few living beings. I never did fire. Johnny and I were deployed with another battalion that was fighting at the Al Jabar airfield in southern Kuwait, and there were enemy officers in the control tower, air control tower on the airfield, and which had all the glass was shot out, and they were rather prime targets. We asked to take shots, asked for permission. We were in our position and prepared to shoot, but we were asked to hold off. And then later in the day, as the infantry did their work on the airfield, a group of Iraqis, probably a little less than a platoon, they were attempting to surrender, but there was no one near to surrender to. They had their boots off and strung around their necks and were waving T-shirts or underwear, whatever kind of white material they'd found. And eventually they just sat down and began eating their rations, and I guess they assumed that someone would come along that they could surrender to. And I was somewhat frustrated with those men, and because, you know, I obviously couldn't shoot them, but I popped around from head to head, pretending that I might have.
You did that in your mind's eye, you mean?
I did that with my rifle, with my scope.
And then you took them prisoner, or what happened then?
Someone else took them prisoner.
How did you find out the war was over?
Well, in a rather peculiar way, my partner Johnny and I had been on a mission, and over the course of the mission, which was about a day, we'd seen a lot of retreating Iraqi vehicles, and over the radio frequencies, we heard of an occasional fight, an occasional skirmish with troops, but we weren't picked up the next morning when we were supposed to be, which caused us a bit of concern. And we decided to hike our way back to what we knew was supposed to be the last position of our unit. And as we made the rise that was just our side of the flat where our unit was supposed to be, we heard music, and We were kind of concerned. We thought it was a trick. We didn't know really what was happening because the war was still on. And we slowly climbed up this rise, our bellies in the sand. And on the other side of it, there was men from our battalion with their shirts off playing football. Jimi Hendrix, I think, was piping through the comm towers. The first sergeant who'd played the game with a kazoo was handing out cigars, and everyone was happy because the war was over. And that's how Johnny and I found out that things had ended.
Now, after the war was declared over, you took part in the cleanup operation, and you went through Iraqi bunkers, and you write that you all gleefully ran through the enemy positions and noting the hundreds of different ways a man might die when 500-pound bombs are dropped on a weakly fortified position. And a Marine in your battalion became obsessed with one of the Iraqi corpses. What was the nature of his obsession?
Well, for this Marine, I think the corpse both signified hope because he was alive, and also maybe despair because the war had ended and he'd been looking for more of a fight, and perhaps he was already having trouble with the issue of having not really been involved in a long war.
What did he do to the corpse?
Well, he desecrated the corpse. He took his e-tool to it, which is a small folding shovel, and he made this corpse his kind of special project and went at it daily until it was buried.
Who buried it?
I did. I was tired of knowing that was happening. It was sickening and troubling. And though this Marine probably went on to another corpse to do the same, and he had his reasons for doing that. They're not probably not acceptable to anyone.
Did you take anything from these Iraqi bunkers with you?
Yeah, I did. I took some dog tags off of a few corpses. Their dog tags were rather crude things, whereas in the U.S. we use a press, and their dog tags are just on thin sheets of metal, and the information is scrawled in with an awl. And I still have those dog tags.
Yeah, there's a lot of mythology about dog tags. I think you write in the book that people would order tons of them to surround themselves with as many pairs as possible, so as if that would be a talisman against death.
Yeah, absolutely. The idea that your mother has a pair, and your little brother and your girlfriend, and you nail them to the wall in some bar in the Philippines, and you've spread yourself so far and wide that there's no way you can die because your dog tags are out there kind of pulsing in the air, around the globe.
Anthony Swofford's new memoir is Jarhead.